Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. As always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, at AH Malcolm on Twitter, or X, the Statler to my Waldorf.
That's right.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. A Monday pretending to be a Tuesday, or the other way around.
Tuesday pretending to be a Monday. Yeah, it was kind of a Monday all the way around for me too. Yeah. Not the least of which is I was stuck on, you know, conference calls that I normally do on Mondays. You know, it just is what it is. But lots of stuff to discuss, though. I mean, we've got tons of stuff to discuss, including your latest entries over at Red State. You know, we can actually go back to last week, too, because you had one that for Thursday. Since someone needs to say it, we have no real president now. And I think we got a little bit more evidence of that over the weekend. And a related column, which was on Saturday, I guess, right? The more that Joe Biden campaigns, the worse his polls get, and Trump gains even while stuck in court. And I want to talk about the court aspect today, because that's part of the landscape today. Okay. But tell us a little bit about not having a real president and how that's impacting the race.
We've seen documented virtually every time Joe Biden goes into public that he's not up to the job. He's not up to getting off a stage by himself. He's not up to even reading the teleprompter. He has to have notes that tell him to sit down when he goes into a meeting. And nobody's doing anything about it. I mean, you would think, although it would stick us with Kamala Harris, but which is his insurance policy, you would think that someone, you know, I guess it's the majority of the cabinet and the vice president, must move to invoke the 25th Amendment if the president isn't up to this, if they don't think he's up to the job. But I mean, clearly he's not up to the job. He's making mistakes all over the place. He doesn't know where he is. He had trouble opening a screen door the other day. Someone had to show him how to do it. And nobody does anything. Now, you can understand the power dynamics, because if anyone threw Joe Biden out, that means they're losing their cushy White House job and the power that goes with it. And Jill Biden, wouldn't be able to wear her goofy dresses to state dinners anymore. But it's disconcerting, because there's nothing to do and nobody is doing anything. The media certainly isn't calling him out. They report on his worst blunders, but they're so obsessed with the Trump trial. And I guess we could talk about that a little bit too, but I don't know. We're kind of stuck in between, and there's a lot of risks involved with this. Putin didn't invade Ukraine during Trump's term. Iran wasn't attacking Israel during Trump's term. The Houthis were a problem, but they weren't attacking international shipping. And Hamas wasn't a problem. So it just seems like they're trying to take advantage of this closing window on the poor, weak president's term.
Yeah, you know, it's almost as if the trial is sort of this moment in time that's frozen, right? And what's interesting about that, right, is that Joe Biden picked today to, or not really today, over the weekend, to start using the trial as part of his campaign, right? He and his campaign had stayed away from it for good reasons, because you don't want to make it look political, right? So the last thing you want to do is have the president interceding in a, even rhetorically, in a criminal trial.
Although it's okay if it's your son, Hunter. Yeah. Go ahead. Well,
yeah, I mean, at least it's explicable, but I'll tell you why I find this so interesting is that this actually came up in the Manson trial. This is how old I am. I read about it. I wasn't watching the trial at the time. I was, I think, 9 years old or 8 years old at the time. But I read about it a few years later from Vincent Bugliosi's book. And there was a very noteworthy moment in the trial where Richard Nixon had said, it looks like they're guilty, or words to that effect. He'd been asked about the Manson family. And rather than just say, well, the jury is going to have to make a decision on that, it's really not appropriate for a president to opine on that, which is what he should have said, right? Nixon apparently said something about them looking guilty. And the Los Angeles Times carried that as their headline. You know, Nixon proclaims Manson guilty. And in the trial, Charles Manson jumps up and holds up the newspaper and shows it to the jury and says words like, well, if the president said it must be true or something like that. And damn near caused a mistrial. And the judge in that case correctly ruled that the defendant can't generate a mistrial based on his own misconduct. And that if he wants to show that to the jury, then that's on him. But now you have Joe Biden saying he's going to come out and have announcing, I'm going to have a speech from the White House when the verdict comes in. Well, why?
First off, attention.
First off, why announce it now? Right? Why not wait until after the verdict comes in and say, okay, in an hour, I'll have a statement, or tomorrow, I'll have a statement from the White House about the trial. So it makes it look politicized, right? It makes the whole thing look politicized. But that was nothing compared to what happened this morning. Did you see the Robert De Niro presser for the Biden campaign, which was, it was a block away from the courthouse? The Biden campaign had a press conference, had a campaign event, at least in the vicinity of the trial, while the jurors are not sequestered.
Yeah.
I mean, I find this stunning. It's clearly an attempt to influence the jury, yeah, and to try to lift Joe Biden's, you know, desperation campaign. And even Politico was saying that they're desperate, they're panicking over the polls. I mean, to me, this is, I guess maybe it just isn't done. Presidents don't do this, especially in the Island Province. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. They don't. They shouldn't. But Joe Biden does, and his people do, because, as you say, they're so desperate. On the other hand, it gives Trump's lawyers great grounds for appeal if the verdict does find him guilty.
You know, I mean, we've got to talk a little bit about the whole Robert De Niro thing, him melting down out there, and then getting into it with a heckler. If you're going to pick anybody to be out there, why Robert De Niro? I mean, the guy he rants. That's all he does. He's interesting on screen. Off screen, he's a nutcase. Who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah.
Who's next,
yeah.
John Kitzak?
Well, you know, he has been, as you know, a big Biden booster, and he said some caustic things about Trump. So I guess if you're desperate, let's get Robert De Niro up there. We'll get the cameras there. And to that extent, it worked.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it worked, but I think it's going to backfire because I think it makes it look like this whole thing is very political, which it is.
It is. Of course it is. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It is. And it's lawfare. And I think it's going to spill over in terms of reputation to any of the other trials that get going, if they ever do. I think an awful lot of, well, there was a poll I tweeted about it some weeks ago that it was a CNN poll of all things, saying that a majority of Americans believe that Trump was not getting equal treatment under the justice. And I think that's why the feds decided not to prosecute him on this bullshit charge, covering up the books.
And I guess that they are now, because their closing arguments are going on as we speak. The defense's closing arguments has wrapped up. And I want to talk a little bit about the coverage of that at the New York Times. But apparently the prosecution, because even though Donald Trump was apparently unaware of this until yesterday, if you go by his Truth Social feed, in criminal trials in New York, and I think in most states, the prosecution gets the first closing argument, the defense gets a closing argument, and then the prosecution can rebut, because they have the burden of carrying the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So usually they get a chance to rebut at the end. I don't think every state has that, but California I know does, and New York does, and I think most other states have that same arrangement. Trump found that to be biased, but that's just the way it is. I mean, that's not new. But apparently in the second closing argument, the rebuttal closing argument now, they're making the case, according to Andy McCarthy over at NRO, that the crime that they're saying that he was trying to cover up was the federal crime that the federal government didn't want to prosecute and that they didn't even want to process as a civil charge. You know, the NDA payment to Stormy Daniels, whom I have to admit this, I called Sonny Daniels for some reason in that post I just got in writing. And somebody asked me in the comment sections, is this a climate change thing? Like, damn. Hate it when I do.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I mean, that's your point. They didn't even want to, the federal government didn't want to prosecute this because they tried that with John Edwards and it was a bomb. It didn't work. So the FEC didn't even want to issue a fine over it. And now you've got Alvin Bragg claiming that they were trying to cover up a crime that the FEC and the Department of Justice wasn't even interested in. I mean, if that's the case here, I mean, Juan Merchan really should be throwing this thing out. He should be issuing a directed verdict at the end of this summation from the prosecution team. And I imagine that Todd Blanch is probably going to move for that. But this is, that's really a strange claim to make.
Well, anyway. The public sees the desperation, and Americans, they're not sharp. But they are relentless in the public, the American public. They don't pay specific attention every day, but over the long run, they detect unfairness when it's as blatant as this is. Now, I don't know that it's going to affect the jury, but I think it would affect the vote, which is probably more important. You know, we are in such a pickle here. I don't know. I've never seen anything like it. And I don't know where we're going with this, but I've decided to write about other things.
Yeah, Banana Republic Land is where we're going with this. I mean, I want to just discuss how the New York Times is covering this, just because I found this to be very amusing. Did I talk to you about doing the I don't think we've had a chance to talk since last week. It was a week ago. I did a dramatic reading of the transcript from Monday's cross-examination of Michael Cohen. Good Logic, I think is the name. Joe Nearman is his name, and he's a podcaster with a very large audience, and this he routinely does this. He routinely does dramatic readings of transcripts, especially in this case, so that people understand what's going on because there's no TVs in the courtroom. So I'm reading through this, and this is the last day of cross-examination of Michael Cohen, right? Who's the only witness that is testifying that this was a cover-up, that this was a scheme to cover things up. Right, that the payments to him were reimbursements for the Stormy Daniels payment, not the Sunny Daniels payment. Sunny Daniels payment. But and that the retainer fee ledger entry was falsified to cover it up. Well, as it turns out, Todd Blanche gets Michael Cohen to admit that he was doing a lot of legal work for Trump during that same period of time. And that was the only compensation he was getting, which makes it look like, no, this is actually payment for legal services, not for reimbursements. And at least in some part, you know, to some extent, this was payment for legal services being provided. And he was getting paid less by Trump than his other corporate clients and was doing a lot more work for the Trumps than he was doing for his other corporate clients. I think AT&T, if I recall correctly, there was several of these corporate clients he had. AT&T was paying him $100,000 a month, you know, as opposed to Trump paying him $35,000 a month. And I think with AT&T, he had 6 total consultations with them over a 12-month period. Got paid $1.2 million for 6 consultations. In the meantime, he's doing stuff for Trump damn near every day on this $35,000 retainer. Anyway, the point I'm making with this is that if those records, if those payments were for legal services, then there's no falsification of those records. They're accurately shown as legal fees, right? And Cohen's making this argument today. Let me, as a former New York Times guy, back when the New York Times was actually the New York Times.
Yeah, it's changed. Yeah,
it's changed. This is how the New York Times reported this just like a couple hours ago. Mr. Trump's lead lawyer, Todd Blanche, repeatedly accused Mr. Cohen of telling lies. They do put that in scare quotes on the stand during his closing argument, saying that there was not a shred of evidence that Mr. Trump had plotted to falsify records. He also argued that there was nothing false about the documents because Mr. Cohen had, in fact, performed legal work and suggested that Mr. Trump had little reason to pay attention to them in any case because he was, quote, the leader of the free world at the time. But Mr. Blanche's argument was at times perplexing. He sometimes called extra attention to elements of the prosecution's case and repeatedly emphasized Mr. Cohen's position as Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, even as he was impugning his character. Well, what's perplexing about that? That's exactly the defense argument in this case, is that, yes, he was Trump's lawyer. That's what he was getting paid for. So therefore, the records weren't falsified at all. There's no case. Yeah. I don't understand how a reporter...
what do they call it? That cognitive dissonance. You see what you want to see or what you expect to see. And so they're going to find that. It's also questionable that they're questioning the guy who was hired by their guy to do legal work, which puts their guy in. What the hell is he doing? You know, he said he was going to have the gold standard cabinet, and then he ended up firing half of them. Whenever he would fire one of them, I would tweet. Anyway, who hired this guy anyway? Oh, wait.
Sorry, I stepped on it.
That's okay. Yeah. Yeah. We should fire the guy who, it was me. Yeah.
We did. We're apparently going to rehire him now at some point. So, yeah. But technically, we actually did fire the guy who did that. At any rate, you know, the media coverage of this has just been bad all the way around.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful.
By the way, was obvious to people who were in the courtroom on Monday. Now, this is
what was obvious?
The fact that what Todd Blanche was arguing here when he was questioning Michael Cohen was the fact that he actually was Trump's lawyer. He had personal attorney to President Donald J. Trump in his email signature. He was doing legal work, not just for Donald Trump, but for Melania Trump and for Tiffany Trump briefly and some other Trump family business. And he didn't stop being Trump's lawyer for 18 months when Trump decided to pick Rudy Giuliani as his personal attorney in regards to the Robert Mueller investigation, which Michael Cohen really wanted instead. And Cohen got really unhappy about that and ended up deciding to start working against Trump because of it. He was being cut out.
This sound like the mafia?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Some guy doesn't get made capo, so he turns and he sets up the assassination, and oh my God.
You know, I wasn't even going to go down this road, and this is a total tangent, but have you ever seen the movie Kill the Irishman?
No.
Well, now you're a Cleveland guy, right? At least.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's the movie is about Danny Green, who took on the mob in Cleveland. Ended up getting killed, but not before he survived a number of attempts on his life. And the mob ended up destroying itself over it. This is, you know, in the 70s, there's all these bombings going on in Cleveland. I wasn't sure if you might recall.
I was gone by then, but yeah.
Yeah. You should watch it. You should watch it. It's really good. It was actually shot in Detroit because Cleveland has cleaned itself up too much to be the, by the time they were making this movie, Cleveland actually improved things
The downtown is really nice now. I hear there's all these nightclubs and bars along the river that once caught on fire.
They couldn't shoot it in Cleveland because it was too modernized, so they went to Detroit, which was in the middle of the collapse at the time. This movie came out maybe 10 12 years ago, maybe longer ago than that, and it's a really good movie though, Kill the Irishman. Anyway, but that was part of that whole thing too, was mob succession, right? One capo didn't get it. So it was, you know,
yeah.
I'm sorry, total tangent, but yeah, I mean, so, you know, I'm looking at the media coverage of this. Nobody in the media picked up on that part of the cross-examination, which went right to the heart of the case. If Michael Cohen is actually performing legal work for Donald Trump and the $35,000 a month is the only compensation he's getting for that, then the records aren't false. Records simply aren't false. There's no falsification going on, which is supposed to be the instrument of this conspiracy to cover something up. Plus all the perjury. I mean, plus all the perjury. We'll just add
in. The perjury, yeah, right.
Well, you know, yeah, the perjury. You know, one more media thing, and then I want to get to your memories column.
Yeah, good.
You know the actor Richard Dreyfuss, right?
Yes.
You know, Jaws. He was in.
What was it? What About Bob? That was the funniest one.
Really good. He was good in it too. What About Bob? Yeah. He was also in. Oh gosh. The Goodbye Girl. I think he just played basically a version of himself in it, but he was brilliant at doing it, where he plays the actor.
He was in American Graffiti.
He was actually in The Graduate too, a small role in The Graduate. It was his, I believe, his first film role. So he's been around for a while. You know, he did the remake of Poseidon Adventure a few years back. That may have been one of his last or most recent roles. He doesn't work as much as he used to. I think he's got some health issues. But over the weekend, he went to the Cabot Theater, which is in Massachusetts. I'm not sure if it's near Boston or not, where they were doing a retrospective of the movie Jaws, which came out 49 years ago, right? And he was, you know, the biologist in Jaws.
Yeah.
And he was very good in that, too. So they wanted to talk to him about Jaws and about Hollywood and stuff like that. And he ends up talking about things like, you know, the Me Too movement in Hollywood, forced diversity for, you know, on actors where you have to be a member of a, you know, particular identity group in order to play a role on the, you know, in that identity group. And also the transgender stuff. And I guess a lot of people got angry and walked out. I don't know what he said. And that's the problem, because neither did the people who were reporting the incident. A Hollywood Reporter has a big long thing, right? Where all they're doing is quoting people from their Twitter feeds and never even approximate what it was that Richard Dreyfuss had said that got them angry in the first place. The only quote they had from Richard Dreyfuss was from a YouTube video from 2 years ago on a completely different topic. Had nothing to do with whatever it was that fired up the crowd over the weekend. I think it was Saturday night. And I read through that article, and I don't know if they've updated it since then. It was this morning when I read through that article, and I was thinking to myself, I've got to talk to Andrew about this. The Boston Globe actually called a couple of people who were in the audience, and they got at least an approximation of what supposedly got them angry. But at least they did something. The two people, two reporters at the Hollywood Reporter, the only thing they did was apparently read social media feeds and banged it into a you know, a THR report, and calling, you know, implying that Richard Dreyfuss was bigoted, homophobic, and transphobic.
Yeah.
Sexist.
Yeah. Well, and you know, anything for clicks, that doesn't matter if it's true. Truth doesn't, no, don't have time for truth.
So are we living in a post-truth world? Is that what you're telling me? Truth doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter as much as it used to. You know, I love the internet. There's a downside to it, and that is that when newspapers were dominant and monopolies in cities, they had a lot of control, and they got arrogant. And so they published what they thought was news, what they decided was news, and everything else, you know, went to hell. As my father used to say, isn't it amazing, Andy, how every day just enough news happens to fill one newspaper? And so they got arrogant. But and so the problem was that you couldn't get in, you couldn't get corrections of whatever. They were arrogant big shots. Now we have the internet, which is, you know, chaos defined. And the priority has changed from getting it right and being authoritative in the old days of the newspaper to being hot, controversial, and getting a lot of clicks. So it's warped the news judgment, I think. So that if it's that you say about TV news, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, you know, if it's controversial, it gets online, and Americans are not the most attentive to what they're reading. So they read it, they get excited, that gets more clicks, they pass it around, gets on social media, and this phrase I hate, which is goes viral. And it probably has nothing to do with the truth. If my evaluation of Richard Dreyfuss is anywhere near accurate, he's probably enjoying watching this chaos.
I am actually not sure about that.
Well, I don't care.
You know, I actually interviewed him once a long time ago, 13 years ago at CPAC, where I was surprised to find him, actually, because Richard Dreyfuss is pretty much a old school liberal, you know, what Joe Biden used to be, basically. He showed up at CPAC because he was pushing something he still does push. It's a civics initiative. He wants K through 12 schools, especially public schools, to start teaching civics again.
Imagine that.
Well, you know, I think it was a good idea. So he decided that he was going to show up at CPAC to try to promote this. And he was very nervous to be around your opponents, be surrounded by your opponents, especially in their on their home turf, you know, can be pretty disquieting. I appreciated that. But I had a nice interview with him. I actually included it in a post that's going to come up later today. And I went back and tried to find it on YouTube. And I found it because Town Hall at that time was pretty good about making sure these things get into the YouTube accounts. You want to guess how many? It's 13 years ago. I want to guess how many views this thing had?
No.
13. 13 views in 13 years. I was proud of that one, baby.
Well, that shows you what a good interview will do, unless it's sexy.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I was in my post. I say this was 13 years, about 100 pounds ago. The last thing this thing was sexy. Trust me on that. But yeah, I mean, but it was interesting. It was interesting. It's always stuck with me. I've always respected him because he was willing to engage, right?
Yes. And, yeah, there are some like that. And John Voight is another one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people who show up, who cross, you know, I'll give you another example, and it's going to surprise some people, but Paul Begala, who is, I think, on CNN. I think he's a CNN analyst, and he's been there for years. And I want to say it was maybe the same CPAC, or it was one that was pretty close in time to that. But Paul Begala was there on the main stage, right? Richard Dreyfuss was making the rounds through the media stuff, right? Paul Begala was on the center stage, engaging with people and being pretty charming. I actually met him briefly backstage, and he was nice enough. Of course, you know, he's sort of on my turf. So I can imagine, you know, you kind of want to be friendly under those conditions. But I've met people who are cold, you know, distant, or you know, sort of, you know, silently sneering, I think is a good way. And Paul Begala wasn't that at all. And I don't agree with Paul Begala, but I did respect him for doing that. Van Jones would be another one who's willing to engage, at least, even though some of his stuff is just batshit nuts. But, yeah, you know, and that's what angers me about the media reaction to Dreyfuss. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. But engaging, showing up, that gets a lot of respect from me, and I think a lot of Americans. That's what Trump did in the Bronx. And that's what Trump did when he went to the Libertarian convention. Oh. You get booed or whatever, but there you are making your case. And the media, because they hate Trump, they love to present it as, oh, look how he was rejected. But the reality is that, never mind the people who were there, thousands more saw him try to make his case, and I, as far as I know, make his case, just not received well. And they appreciated the fact that he did it. And therefore, the argument that he's making becomes irrelevant. He showed up and asked to vote. That's what, you know, if you watch the Trump's Bronx appearance, the TV people found all kinds of folks there. They said, well, you know, he came here. This is not Republican turf. He came here to make a bid. Republicans have not been that good at it over the years. And Trump is. He can make news. He can be the center of attention. And I don't care what his motive is. He does it. And I think it works over the long run.
I wrote a book about that.
Showing up and going red.
Showing up. I mean, even if you don't necessarily go red in that cycle, showing up matters, you know, engaging matters. And yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the Libertarian Party thing.
As long as we don't forget to get to my memory.
We do. We should. Just briefly. I was surprised that the Libertarians actually extended the invitation. They extended it to Biden too, and he didn't want to do it. But I mean, what was that? I mean, what was that about? This is their nominating convention. Why did they have the Republican nominee? I understand why Trump showed up. I'm just not necessarily sure why the Libertarians offered him the venue in the first place.
Gets attention, I guess. Yeah.
Clicks maybe. All right. I'm still mystified by that. So the story a Black Rock told me on a Montana mountain. I know you spent quite a bit of time in Montana. So
yes, I lived there. Yeah. Yeah.
I knew that. But tell us a little bit about this Black Rock on.
Well, I've been doing for the last year or so a series of personal memories that Jennifer Venlar, the editor at Red State, asked me to do because I shared with her some stories verbally that over the years. And she said, you know, you should write these up. And I thought, nah, who cares? But I did. And they've been quite popular. I enjoy writing, and they're outside the paywall. So it's access for anybody who wants to go to Red State. And each one of the memories has a list of all the other memories at the bottom. This one concerned a hike that my wife and I took on a Montana mountain with a local man some years ago. I won't spoil it for everybody, but the snow was melting. This is late spring in the mountains in Montana. There's still snow around, and that's good because it feeds the creeks for longer into the hot summer. So we were walking, the snow was glistening. We were walking along this path, animal path, and here's a big rock. It's like the size, black rock, the size of a huge turkey platter. And it's sitting there, and so we started figuring out the story of it, and I won't spoil it for anybody else, but it the rock had been there forever. It started up on the mountain, and for a variety of natural reasons, it's working its way down the mountain, and so are the animals that use that rock for life. And it was another window for me into the many minute worlds that are going around us all the time that we don't always see or hear or understand. And that's been a theme in my life, whether it involves space or wildlife, is when I used to go out to the school bus as a little boy in rural Ohio, I would see in the snow footprints of deer and raccoon and birds and a weasel one time and rabbits. And I didn't realize it at the time. I would track them and see where they went and where they came from and all that. I didn't realize at the time, but it gave me a very wonderful sense of, I guess, belonging. Here I was living in the countryside, and all the time I was blissfully asleep inside that old house, other worlds and lives were going on all around me, and I didn't know about it. It sort of tuned me in to watch for those. And this black rock took me through another window in to see this grand scheme of life that we don't always see or hear or appreciate. So I just wanted to share that moment. It's a seminal moment in my life.
You know, it's interesting how, this isn't really a pun intended pun, but how touchstones like that really do, you carry those through your life.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, maybe absolutely.
Talisman might even be a good phrase for that. There are certain things, certain experiences that you have that aren't necessarily even events, but there's certain things that you carry through your life as sort of a touchstone. And this story is, I think, one of those for you. And I think.
Absolutely. And judging by a reader response, it's very popular today. But as I say, it's outside the paywall. But it's sort of like a little mini revelation that, you know, you're walking along and suddenly you hear something and it sticks with you. There were little pieces of that. Remember Citizen Kane?
Yes.
There were little pieces of that in there. Where you see something and it's little, and in the scheme of things, it doesn't matter, except it does. And it sticks in your memory.
You know, yeah, I got to say, I was never a big fan of the movie Citizen Kane, but you're right about it.
I love it.
I don't know why. It just.
Well, because you're an idiot. That's why. You have no taste for movies. So read Ed Morrissey's reviews. If he doesn't like it, then you got to go see it, and vice versa.
Maybe I should start writing my reviews, you know, like from Reverse Land or something like that, so I could don't go see the movies I don't like. But
you know, when I was in journalism school, we had a teacher that had us pick something. I picked a school play, I think it was. What, you could pick the Chicago Symphony or something, pick something and go and, like a cultural reporter, write a review about it. And I wrote a review, and he pointed out that most of the reviews were negative. when we turned our papers in, most of the reviews were negative. And he said, and you know why that is? It's because that's the easiest thing to do as the crap on something. And then he said, okay, now your next assignment, go and write a review that's the exact opposite of the one you just wrote. And he forced us to see something really, really good about this play. And it was a wonderful exercise to open up your eyes to see, I guess you could say, how to twist things, but it's not really twisting. It's just to force you to see things from another direction. And that helped my reporting over a long period of time. And obviously, this is a few years later, right, Ed, from my university days, that I remembered it. And that was a good lesson.
Well, we were just discussing this. Christian and Toto and I were just discussing this, not in today's Off the Beaten Path, but I think it was last week's, about writing reviews and about how you can't give in to the impulse to just really let the id fly when you don't like something, right? Because it's really easy and very clickable to turn all sorts of new, you know, turns of phrases, you know, to create, you know, to coin new phraseology to talk about how bad something is. There was a Berkeley breathed Bloom County cartoon, which I loved that cartoon back in the day, even though breathed was, you know, very liberal and had a very liberal point of view. He was, for the most part, especially with the exception of maybe the last couple of years that strip ran, was pretty balanced in making fun of everybody, right? And you know the character Opus the Penguin, right? You've seen that, Bill the Cat, Opus the Penguin. Yeah. Opus the Penguin was writing a review of, it was supposedly this movie called Benji Saves the Universe. He's just overwhelmingly floored in how bad this thing was in the first two panels, right? And the third panel, he's just staring at the typewriter. And the fourth panel, he's typing, well, maybe it wasn't that bad, but Lord, it wasn't good. I gotta say, it's equally easy to write a completely fawning, or it's maybe not equally easy, but it is almost as easy to write a completely fawning, total, you know, love it, love it, love it, there's nothing wrong with this, everybody should go see this, if you hate it you have no taste, sort of like what you just did with me with Citizen Kane. Not that I'm keeping score, Andrew.
But you know what? Remember in Citizen Kane, Citizen Kane's wife sings opera and she's awful at it. And Joseph Cotton, who's the reviewer on Orson Welles' newspaper, starts to write a terrible review, but passes out from being drunk. And Orson Welles sees the review and sits down and finishes it terribly negative. And when Joseph Cotton comes conscious again, he fires him. But he had the integrity in the movie anyway. So I just love those original little twists.
I agree that part, you know. And again, it's a great movie. It just for some reason doesn't resonate with me very well. But
okay. Well, this is our last podcast together, so.
Talking about me like I'm some sort of a Steelers fan. Oh wait! But you know, I think is more difficult is writing something that you are ambivalent. Writing a fair review of something that you're actually ambivalent about, especially if you have friends that are involved in it, then it becomes almost impossible. But
yeah, nuance is very hard, and online nuance does not value. I mean, online the internet does not value nuance. It's, oh, this is terrible or this is great. More likely terrible because it gets more clicks. Anger works.
That's it exactly.
And speaking of anger, I have some jokes.
I was going to say, and Andrew, I'm kind of angry at you right now, so you better tell me some jokes to cheer me up. I'm
just joking. Well, I have two of them that I got from a woman on TikTok that I thought it was very funny. She said, and you may have heard one of them, and she said, the people in Abu Dhabi don't like the Flintstones, but the people in Dubai don't like the Flintstones, but the people in Abu Dhabi do. I just love that one.
That's pretty good. And, I like.
Yeah, and there's another one which a woman gets on a bus with her baby, and she pays her fare, and the bus driver says, "That is probably the ugliest baby I've ever seen." And the woman is crushed, and she goes and sits down in the back, and she looks at the man, and she says, "The bus driver just insulted me and my baby." And the guy next to her says, "Well, here, let me hold your monkey. Go tell him off."
All right, I got a couple for you. I have a couple for you. An office employee knows that his boss is off for the day, so he transfers his telephone to his cell phone so he can go out and play golf. And he's about, 13th hole, and his phone starts ringing. He answers it, and it's his boss. He says, "So how's everything going?" The employee goes, "Oh, everything's going fine. Everything's going fine." And the boss says, "Well, then move your ass, because I'm the foursome behind you." That's jokesoftheday.net. And then I got this one from Instagram. So, and I sent it over to you, so you know this joke, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Man brings his best buddy home for dinner without telling his wife. They show up at 7:30. His wife is just lighting into him while his friend just sits and listens. She says, "My hair and makeup aren't done. The house is a mess. The dishes aren't done. I'm still in my pajamas, and I didn't want to cook tonight. What the hell were you thinking bringing him here?" The husband says, "Well, he's thinking about getting married, and I just wanted to give him a demo." So there you go. Hey-o. And of course, we don't need to demo Andrew Malcolm. He is of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com. Redstate.com is where you can find everything that he's writing, including the stuff that is his memory series, which are outside the paywall. And of course, you can find him on Twitter at AH Malcolm. We never call it X here, by the way. We always call it Twitter. No,
it's Twitter. It's always Twitter.
At AH Malcolm. So, Andrew, until next week, we will meet again.
Okay. And it'll be another month. My favorite month of the year.
June.
Oh, June is wonderful. June Saturdays are the best days of the year. There's only four of them. But June Saturdays, that means you've still got Sunday. And in June, you've still got July and August. It's like a three-day weekend. Oh, we just had one.
Had one? Yeah, we just had one. So yeah. There you go. All right, Andrew.
All right, buddy. Take care. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.